Kentucky College of Arts and Sciences podcast. Denise Ho is an assistant professor of history at the University of Kentucky. In this podcast, she interviews John Kam, a visiting scholar and the founder and director of the Duy Hua Foundation. Kam discusses the role of the Duy Hua Foundation's advocacy work in a global context.
This is the next in our series of podcasts about the Year of China. Today we're here with Mr. John Kam, who is the founder and executive director of the Duy Hua Foundation. Last night he was the keynote speaker for our kickoff for the second semester of the Year of China at the University of Kentucky. And he's been on campus since yesterday and has been talking to UK undergrads and graduate students and faculty about his work and the work of his foundation. So welcome, Mr. Kam.
Well, thank you very much, Denise. It's a pleasure to be here.
Perhaps one way I can start us off is to ask you to introduce your foundation, the Duy Hua Foundation. From the website, I see the slogan is Advancing Rights Through Dialogue, Yi Duy Hua Chang Ren Quan. Can you tell us a little bit more about the organization, perhaps starting with its name and what its goals are?
The organization was established in 1999. At that time, I had been doing this work, that is, conducting what we call an unofficial dialogue with the Chinese government on prisoners and prison conditions. I'd been doing that since 1990. But in 1999, I was given the opportunity of applying for a grant. To get the grant, I needed to have what is known as a pass-through organization. More technically, in this case, a 501c3 nonprofit organization. So I established Duy Hua, got our first grant, and began building the organization to the point where today we have 10 employees, mm-hmm. Two offices, one in San Francisco, one in Hong Kong. And I travel frequently to China to engage the Chinese government in this dialogue. And Duy Hua means dialogue. Mm-hmm. So that's what we're about. Our approach is respectful and results-oriented. We eschew publicity as appropriate. I must say sometimes it is useful to do some publicity, outreach, media interviews, etc. And we have recently expanded our mission to cover what we call detainees at risk. So in addition to individuals who have been detained for the nonviolent expression of their political and religious beliefs, we have expanded our work into three other fields. One is juvenile justice reform. Another is issues related to women in prison. And finally, death row inmates. And I might add that whereas that first group, what some call political prisoners, we don't do much in the United States. Although certainly there are people in prison for national security violations, we also do work in the other three areas mm-hmm. involving the United States. So we do try to be balanced. Mm-hmm. We don't assume any position of superiority. Our position is that everyone has problems, and we need to work together to try to address those problems. We do not follow the approach often referred to as naming and shaming for various reasons. Instead, we pursue the course of dialogue.
Thank you. One of the things I was particularly struck by in your talk last night, and I think one of the ways in which you connected very well with our students, is by talking about how you first got involved in studying Chinese language and then how that transitioned into a work in business and then in human rights. I wonder if you would summarize for our listeners, what first attracted you to China and caused you to engage in the field of human rights?
I graduated from high school, Neptune High School in New Jersey, in 1969. And that happened to be the year that Princeton University admitted women, mm-hmm. admitted more minorities and admitted a significant number of high school students from New Jersey. So I got into Princeton. And in those days, in the late 60s, Princeton was one of the few universities in the country that offered Chinese. And my mother suggested and convinced me that I should take Chinese. So I did, and I, you know, fell in love with the language. And after 3 years of college, I graduated early. I was what was then known as a university scholar. So I graduated early, and I went out to first to Macau, where I was a teacher, and then to Hong Kong, where I was also a teacher. But I began to write for business publications, doing the covering. The first real opening in China was after the Nixon visit in 72. Then Americans could start to go in and do business. So I began to write, and one of the publications I wrote for was the China Business Review, which was the magazine of the National Council for U.S.-China Trade, which was a so-called people-to-people organization involving American companies on the one side and Chinese enterprises and to some extent regulatory agencies. And so I began doing that work. And it was, in fact, as a representative of the National Council that I made my first trip to China in January of 1976 to mainland China. And I recently wrote about that, if listeners are interested. It's an article in the Hong Kong Economic Journal called Shanghaied at the Feather and Down Mini Fair. And it tells the story of my first trip. That was quite a year, 1976. And, of course, probably the biggest event that I witnessed and was present for was the Tangshan earthquake in July of 76. I became more and more involved with business. In 1979, the two countries established diplomatic relations. I resigned and took on agencies to sell products. In this case, chemical products. It could have been anything, but I chose chemical products for a good reason. We adopted my firm a different approach from others, which was that we concentrated on provincial level. I was convinced early on that China would decentralize its trade. And so I set the first office up in Guangzhou, first foreign office in Guangzhou in 79, and then in Shanghai I set up the second or third office in 1980. And so we pioneered trade at the provincial and even sub-provincial level. Well, my business was acquired by one of my principals in 1981, and I rose through the ranks and became vice president of the region. My business was very good, and so good that I could spend time working as an officer at the American Chamber of Commerce. And, of course, that led to my being president right after Tiananmen Square. And, of course, the story has been oft told, but at a banquet hosted by a senior Chinese official a week before I was testifying in Washington, I interrupted the official's toast and asked that he help secure the release of a young student. And that was the first intervention in May of 1990, and that was almost 22 years ago now.
Perhaps I can follow up and ask you how such an intervention works. You talked about the different categories, the four categories or focus areas that the Dui Hua Foundation works on. I wonder if you could walk us through a typical case. You know, how do you decide to get involved? What are the steps in the process? And how does it become resolved to your satisfaction?
Well, let's take a recent case.
Okay.
In fact, I think probably the most recent successful case of a of what would be called an important prisoner in Chinese judicial or penal terminology. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's a definition of an important prisoner. So this is an individual who was, still is now, a scholar, trained at Harvard and Oxford. So he has a PhD from Oxford and a master's from Harvard. Name is Xu Zirong. He's Cantonese, so that's Choi, and he uses David Choi as his name for many of his publications. And he was arrested and convicted of trafficking in state secrets, which is espionage, well, not espionage, it's trafficking in state secrets, and illegal business activity, because he was running an unregistered publication business, mm-hmm. And given a combined sentence of 13 years. I became aware of this particular case by his professors, mm-hmm. Who were advised, I believe, initially by his family. And, of course, it was an important case that had been taken up by NGOs and the U.S. government and the U.K. government, and there was some coverage of it. I didn't find out about this case through our own research. Some cases we do. But in this case, it was sufficiently high profile, and the individual had numerous foreign connections, mm-hmm. So the case was brought to me.
Okay.
Now, in his case, quite typical, I would first of all make sure that his name was on prisoner lists. Mm-hmm. That's my principal tool for intervention, is to put a prisoner's name on a list. Now, it has been the case. There's some question as to the efficacy these days, but it has been the case that prisoners whose names are on lists are, in fact, treated better and do, in fact, gain early release. I did a calculation, I think, in my testimony 2006 to the House of Representatives, where I looked at the fate of individuals who were on a list.
And these are lists generated by governments or by nonprofits or something like Amnesty?
Well, they're all of the above. First of all, there are governments which have what are known as bilateral human rights dialogues with China.
Okay.
The United States, the EU, Australia, Canada, mm-hmm. Switzerland, UK, Germany, Norway, and there's some dispute over terminology, but Japan has had one. So there are these groups, and from time to time, some are suspended.
Mm-hmm.
Norway's is suspended now because of the Nobel decision.
Mm-hmm.
Canada is suspended because the Canadians suspended it, and they can't seem to get it started again. So though that's one set of list providers. And then there's the UN,
mm-hmm.
and the various treaty bodies and thematic mechanisms, and even the Office of the High Commissioner herself occasionally will ask us for assistance in this regard. And then every now and then you'll have, say, a group of congressmen or senators going to China,
mm-hmm.
and we'll help them with the list.
Okay.
And then there are our own lists. So we have that unique ability as an NGO to go to China and submit lists.
Hmm.
And that's, of course, something I've been doing for a long time. Actually, I think my first list was in 1991.
Okay.
So again, more than 20 years ago. So that's a very important component. So the name is always out there, and the Chinese government is responding and giving information and paying attention to this prisoner. In David's case, I actually visited his prison,
mm-hmm.
And struck up a friendship with the officials in the prison.
Mm-hmm.
And after David got into the prison, I asked about him frequently and directly,
mm-hmm.
and I focused on, since he was a scholar, getting him books.
Mm-hmm.
And
very important.
This was a very interesting experience. which I could go into in some detail. But in the end, he finally did get some books. And due to his high profile and being on so many lists, he was transferred from an ordinary prison to a model prison. And in the model prison, he was treated very well. He didn't have to do manual labor. He was allowed plenty of time to write and to research. At the same time, I was busy getting him sentence reductions. Okay. So finally, in June, he was released after his third sentence reduction.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
So in thinking about your role as an advocate, I was thinking that there's advocacy is working at multiple levels, mm-hmm. and perhaps two of them, the two primary ones are the direct advocacy, the kind that you've just described, mm-hmm. trying to improve the treatment of a detainee. And then I think that in thinking about your role as advocate and your speech last night, there's a sense in which you're also an advocate for better understanding of China among the American public, among American politicians. I wonder if you might speak on what's required for an American to be well informed on issues regarding China. The mission statement of, or the one of the goals of the Doihua Foundation is well-informed, mutually respective dialogue with China. So how would you describe what it takes to make an American well-informed on such issues?
Well, that's a big question.
That's a big question.
I mean, it could apply to almost anything, of course.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to get out and speak to the American people.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a lot of that. I've now spoken at more than 50 universities in this country alone, often more than once. So I speak directly to the people, and not only just, of course, at universities, but mm-hmm. at other public forum,
mm-hmm.
World Affairs Councils, the Commonwealth Club of Northern California, and so on and so forth. So nothing, I think, well, of course, you through that method, you reach people very directly, but it's limited in terms of the number of people you can reach. So writing,
mm-hmm.
and I often write and have articles published, you know, just or letters to the editor.
Okay.
I did one for the New York Times recently. So there's, you know, there's, and then just, you know, interacting with people, obviously, on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a website, which has recently been revamped. And we get about 1,000 visitors a day.
Wow.
And sometimes we can get more than 5,000 visitors a day, depending on the subject.
Then perhaps as a way to follow up, I could ask you, suppose one of the listeners in the audience wanted to have a primer on human rights in China, perhaps looking at the sorts of research resources on your the Doihua Foundation's website, how would you instruct a novice in putting together a short primer or course? How would you get started learning about human rights in China?
Well, look, a number of NGOs do quite good work, and the Chinese government itself has become more proactive. So I would take the approach of asking people to read both
mm-hmm.
The Chinese government's position papers, the white papers.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, China now is more and more connected to the world community through the internet. Read blogs
mm-hmm.
Though in English, not just Chinese. People do it. And of course, the publications of governmental bodies and NGOs. The State Department Human Rights Annual Report on China,
mm-hmm.
The Congressional Executive Commission on China, various human rights groups. I believe Human Rights Watch just put out a report. China didn't like it, and China did a rebuttal, so read them both.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of material out there. And our website and our publications, our newsletter, for instance, covers, you know, our own set of topics. You know, it's such a vast field. You know, here we're talking really about what are called civil and political rights.
Mm-hmm.
But that leaves out a huge area, which is economic, social,
sure.
and cultural. And I don't think there's anyone who would challenge the statement that in the field of economic rights, China has made tremendous progress. So, you know, it depends. It's a big field. Trafficking in women and children is a big issue. You see, and there are human rights issues that the position or positions of the Chinese government are very much in line with the positions of the international community. And one of those happens to be juvenile justice. Everyone, I think, would agree that adolescents who make mistakes, commit crimes, should be given a chance to rehabilitate and get a second chance. The adolescent brain, we know, is a very different brain than the adult brain.
Yes, that's true.
And a lot of research has been done on this. And, you know, adolescents take risks that as you get older you don't take. That part of the brain is not well developed. It's well established. So a few years ago, China made it a top priority of their legal reform to reform the juvenile justice system. I mean, they really didn't have a juvenile justice system. And great progress has been made on that. And I'm very proud that Dui Hua has played a leadership role working with the Supreme People's Court, mm-hmm. Office of Juvenile Justice Reform. We've hosted a group to the United States. We've sent one to China. We're about to host another one in the United States this year. So, you know, if you're interested in juvenile justice reform, definitely our website mm-hmm. is a principal resource. If you're interested in trafficking in women and children, I'm sorry to say we haven't done work in that area and we really haven't published materials. So it's such a big field when you say human rights.
Sure.
You really have to kind of drill down and say, okay, well, what are we specifically talking about? Death row inmates, capital punishment, is an area I've been working on for many years. I chaired the plenary session of the World Congress for the Abolition of the Death Penalty in Paris in 2005. And our estimates have become, I think, the most widely accepted, respected estimates for the number of executions in China. And there, too, I think our work has contributed somewhat to the sharp reduction in the number of executions in China in recent years. And that, too, we're very proud of. I'd like to do more work on women and children, women in prison. Mm-hmm. And we're going to hopefully be able to do a seminar on what's known as the Bangkok Rules, which are the first international rules governing the treatment of women in prison. And so that's another area where both the United States and China, the percentage of the prison population made up of by women, mm-hmm. made up of women, has been growing year by year in both countries. And there are many, many issues that need to be tackled here, including in our country. You see?
Yes.
Dialogue
is a two-way street.
Dialogue is not just a channel. Mm-hmm. It's a mirror. Mm-hmm. You see? It's not just about going to that country and saying, hey, you've got these problems, this is what you need to do. It's about looking at yourself in the process. And I must say, with respect to the treatment of women in prison in the United States, there are things we can learn from China. Absolutely. And I think Americans would be shocked to know that in the recent amended criminal procedure law, women who are nursing children can do so outside of prison, including women serving life sentences for murder, are allowed to nurse their children outside of prison by law. I challenge people to find a similar situation in this country.
Thank you very much. I'll look forward to seeing what happens with this new project.
Yep.
Perhaps I can ask one final question to conclude. We've talked about your personal history. We've talked a little bit about kind of more specific aspects of your work. But your talk last night was actually about the relationship between China and the United States. And you ended your talk with reasons to be optimistic about the relationship with United States and China. I wanted to ask you again, what are these reasons and how does the well-informed and mutually respectful dialogue both support and then further these reasons to be optimistic?
Well, one of the reasons is that the principal obstacle to good relations between the United States and China for many years, for decades, has been what's known as the Taiwan question. And really, the heat has been taken out of that issue. Interestingly, because of the development of democracy in Taiwan, I hope my Chinese friends reflect on that a little bit. What happened was that the people of Taiwan, in a free, fair, nonviolent election, elected the individual who they concluded would be best suited for continuing the rapprochement between the mainland and Taiwan. And it was done very openly. It was no skullduggery and what have you. And I might add, China learned from previous experience not to threaten, not to bluster, not to, you know, make dire warnings. Sure, they made it known who they preferred in their own way, but they learned from that experience. So one of the reasons why I think the relationship between the U.S. and China long-term is a good proposition is the not the entire removal, but the reduction in the importance of this issue. So that's one reason. The second reason I pointed out was that the relationship has grown so big and so complicated that I said it's too big to fail. I just rattled off all kinds of numbers, two-way trade, $500 billion, almost certainly in 2011. Of course, if you count U.S. exports to Hong Kong in the mix, then it's well over half a trillion. I'm sorry, I get my trillions and billions mixed up.
Well, the Chinese
do right. So trade, investment. Mm-hmm. But one thing I focused on were, you know, the numbers of Chinese students in this country, which last count was 157,000, both undergraduate and graduate, and the growing number of American students going to China. You know, so many American students are approaching me and asking me, how do I get a job in China? How do I go to China? And it's really a growing number. So we have that, and as you very helpfully pointed out, several of China's senior leaders have children at American universities. There are now, I'm going to estimate, almost 200 sister city and sister province relationships. And I guess finally, and this is by no means an exhaustive list, the United States and China, the people, generally speaking, like each other. Chinese made a great contribution to the development of this country. The United States, although it certainly participated in the Boxer retaliation, the invasion with troops, as you know, the indemnity that was forced on China was in effect used to invest in education in China.
That's right.
And, you know, many Chinese officials have told me, yes, there's a lot of rancor and tension in the relationship, but a lot of Chinese appreciate very much that the United States did keep its market open, which, again, I'm very proud to have played a role in that. My position has never changed. So there's a lot of goodwill there. And polls indicate that. Even though Americans see China as an economic threat, by the way, not a military threat. Poll after poll, Americans don't see China as a military threat. But economic threat, yes. But just because Americans see problems with the relationship doesn't mean they don't like the Chinese. And in fact, the CBS poll, the most recent poll on these attitudes, has about 59% of Americans seeing China either as an ally or a friend. I used the analogy last night. Anyone who's ever raised adolescent children will appreciate that you can have problems with them, but that doesn't mean you don't like them. So, you know, these are the kind of factors that I think go into a long-term optimistic view of the relationship between the two countries.
I think the key then is to see problems but also see opportunities. And increasing relationships is certainly one means to that. And I thank you so much for coming to the University of Kentucky and allowing us to increase this knowledge and relationships between the United States and China.
Thank you, Denise.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to the College of Arts and Sciences, the Dui Hua Foundation, and the Department of History for making this podcast possible. For more information about the Year of China, please visit china.as.uky.edu.